This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's presidential debate season, and the folks on our bloggers roundtable are ready to slice and dice the winners and the losers and give us their 2 cents on how the Veep debate this week could play out. With us, we've got Charles Robinson. He blogs at Charles Black Politics Blog, Issa Yulin, who blogs at IssaYulin.com, and Anthony Bradley, creator of the blog The Institute. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey.
So NPR's Ron Elving and Dr. Julianne Malveau just gave us their take on the big economic bill. Both presidential candidates say they support it. Issa, do you think it's a good idea for the presidential candidates to endorse it when, frankly, it's not quite solid yet? The jelly is still setting.
I think it's important for both candidates to weigh in, and that's why I was so shocked with McCain's shenanigans when he claimed he didn't want to go to the debate down at Ole Miss. Even though this is a work in progress and things are still being ironed out, I think it's important that we know where each candidate stands, particularly because this is something that for at least the next couple of years, whomever's going to be our next president has to continue to deal with this crisis.
It sounds like you think that when Senator McCain said that he might not come to the debates, it wasn't helping. It was hurting.
It was hurting the American people. I think it was hurting his campaign, and it was just kind of bizarre.
Charles, what do you think about that move?
Farai, this was a buy-in. This wasn't a kind of a sellout. But as much as understand this, we're in a very precarious situation. People are talking about a depression, not even a recession anymore. And I think each of these candidates, they couldn't say they didn't want to go with it because essentially they would be saying, all right, I want to send the world into a depression. And this was supposedly the signal. The bigger issue, I think, is what people are saying out in the field. Understand, I just listened to some of the debate coming from the Congress, and I'm going to tell you, this is the toughest vote that they will ever make. Think about it, $700 billion. I can't even imagine what that looks like in one room.
That depends on how big the bills are, I guess. Anthony, do you think that, you know, at this point, when you think about the debate that already happened, I want to transition to that. Do you think that there was a clear definition of economic policy by the two major party presidential candidates?
Well, there was definitely a clear difference. It was interesting if you watched the debate. It was very clear that both candidates have a very different view of the role of government as with respect to managing the economy. And we see with this bailout program that both candidates, as they weigh in, are weighing in cautiously because each candidate's particular base has different perspectives on this issue.
Charles, how do you think that they fared? I mean, you know, a lot of people have been giving their thumbs up and thumbs down. How do you think that the two gentlemen fared?
Well, I want to talk about how I heard this debate. First of all, I listened to it on radio, which was, I think, a lot different than television. In fact, I think McCain won the debate on radio, but I thought Barack won the debate on television. The visual was the key for television viewers. For radio viewers, listeners, if you will, I think it was the simplistic tone of John McCain. And just a plug for NPR, I listened to it on NPR. And it was quite clear to me as I was listening to it that Barack continued to sound professorial, if you will, and trying to give these elongated. John McCain was very simple. I take that situation where Lara asked the question about, well, what would you cut? John McCain cut right to the case. I'm going to cut programs right across the board. Well, you know what? I thought that resonated, whereas the convoluted, I don't know what I'm going to cut, I might cut, I don't know what I'm going to do, was very indecisive. But getting back to the television portion, understand, a challenger who comes to a debate like this, and I think Barack was still the underdog, he stands up with stature and he's able to send the message to those undecided voters. Remember, this is not for the people in the room. It's totally for the undecideds and the people who are outside the room.
Issa, first of all, how did you get the debate? And secondly, you know, some people are saying, well, Obama is considered to have won simply because he didn't lose. There was a low expectation for him because he's not known always as a great debater. How did that play out for you?
Well, I watched it on television with my husband. We were actually invited to a debate party. People have been having those here in New York. But we decided to stay at home that night and watch it together. And I have to say that I think that for those people who are going to support McCain, they're going to feel even more strongly about McCain. And for those Barack supporters, they feel strongly about their candidate. I agree that the toss-ups, the people who are really going to decide this election are the undecideds and independent voters in particular. And I think that for most of them, as you said, because Obama wasn't, if they're unsure about Obama, they're unsure about him being presidential. They're unsure about him making the kinds of decisions that are going to be crucial in the next 4 to 8 years. And I think that because he had those low expectations, he came in at least a draw, then that kind of bumps him up to the winner.
All right. Well, for folks just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This is our bloggers roundtable, and you were just hearing from Issa Yulin, who blogs at issayulin.com. We've also got Charles Robinson, who blogs at Charles Black Politics blog, and Anthony Bradley of the Institute blog. Okay, so we've talked about the last debate, the presidential debate, and then there is a vice presidential debate coming up. It's going to be the only one of the season. Both Governor Palin and Senator Joe Biden have had their moments. Let's listen to a quick clip of Joe Biden talking with CBS News's Katie Couric.
Part of what a leader does is to instill confidence, is demonstrate that he or she knows what they're talking about and communicates to people, if you listen to me and follow what I'm suggesting, we can fix this. When the stock market crashed, Franklin Roosevelt got on television and didn't just talk about the princes of greed. He said, look, here's what happened.
All right, Anthony, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, there's some historical inaccuracies there where Biden obviously put his foot in his mouth because if one actually looks at the historical record, FDR actually wasn't president, and he came in office after the fact to fix Hoover's mess, and that television was in the experimental phase and hadn't been developed yet, and that radio was actually the main medium of communication. So if someone's going to actually listen to Biden, who says you have to know what he's talking about, and then he actually makes a major historical blunder like that, it calls into question some of his own principles.
You know, he's known more for gaffes that have to do with personality, and there was that embarrassing moment where he asked a man in a wheelchair to stand. But this is a different kind. I mean, do you think we're going to get to Sarah Palin in a moment? But Charles, are you surprised that Senator Biden had this kind of historical inaccuracy?
You know, on the stump, you're liable to say anything. I always find it very unusual because, you know, you want to rile up the crowd. You're sitting there and you see all these folks. You want to kind of feed them some red meat. You know what? Hey, I give it to you if you miss a few here and there. But, you know, these are kind of big. The problem is that your opponent will use them against you. And I anticipate that, you know, this is going to be, you know, the Obama-McCain debate was collegial. I don't expect any collegiality in this next debate.
Okay. Well, actually, Governor Palin got her turn with Katie Couric last week. Let's listen to a little bit of her.
It is from Alaska that we send those out to make sure that an eye is being kept on this very powerful nation, Russia, because they are right there.
Okay. Issa. A lot of people have mocked her. And in fact, Katie Couric used the word mocked, to describe the way that Sarah Palin has been viewed lately. And we just heard Charles saying, okay, this is going to be gloves off. If this is a situation where Sarah Palin is being mocked for her foreign policy experience or lack thereof, what kind of gloves are going to be taken off? What do you expect from this debate?
I expect a lot of humor. I think that with
humor?
The...
Humor? Really?
Yeah, I expect to be laughing out loud on Thursday as I watch this debate between the firecracker and the pit. It's going to be the pit bull against the bulldog, and we'll see which dog wins. Biden is sharp. Yeah, he blundered on the FDR thing. I think he was thinking about fireside chats and radio. But Sarah Palin, I mean, she just doesn't have the factual information that's required of someone in an executive position. And it's not just her inability to clearly articulate what she understands. It's her lack of understanding. And, you know, I look forward to Thursday, but I really look forward to Saturday Night Live.
wait, hold that thought, because we have a clip of Tina Fey, one of the most successful women in show business right now, and certainly in comedy, impersonating Governor Palin on this weekend, Saturday Night Live.
Every morning when Alaskans wake up, one of the first things they do is look outside to see if there are any Russians hanging around. If there are, you got to go up to them and ask, what are you doing here? And if they can give you a good reason, they can, then you start responsibility to say, you know, shoo, get back over there.
Anthony, what do you think of this whole, I mean, because there are a lot of people who've been out with comedy. Chris Rock is coming out with some political comedy, but Tina Fey has been on a roll.
Tina Fey
absolutely,
has nailed this role.
Absolutely, because Palin, sadly, has given too much material for comedians to play with. One of the things that the Republicans are going to have to do is have Palin appear knowledgeable and competent. And I hope that they are infusing her with some information capital as we approach Thursday, or else this thing is going to be one of the most comical vice presidential elections that we've seen in quite some time.
Look, I want if you don't mind,
go ahead, sure.
I want everybody to be to think what the Republicans have done in the past. Diminished expectations. What they really want to do is to lower what her level is. The problem is they've been feeding her stuff for the last couple of weeks. The one time she talked to some folks who was in New York at near Ground Zero, and I think this quote-unquote authenticity issue, in other words, she's kind of off the cuff. They're going to give her some one-liners to use back and forth. The problem that I see is that she may use this parody of her to her advantage. In other words, no one believes that I'm going to be good. No one thinks that. Well, let me tell you who I am, kind of thing.
Well, but Charles, there's an Associated Press investigation that just came out. It found, although Governor Palin said she didn't take gifts or handouts, she did take some gifts, even wrote some thank you notes, and more importantly, got the town to sign off on a special zoning exception so she could sell her home. Do you think an investigation like this, investigative reporting, I mean, is going to come out in the debate?
Remember, they've attacked the media the entire time. In other words, no one likes me, so, you know, I'm going to just do what I'm going to do. Think about this. She's got this investigation that you just talked about, and she still has the one that's hanging over from the firing of one of her secretaries. And I think what they've come to the simple realization, it's good to run against the media because nobody likes us and nobody wants to hear from us. And if they can get their message through, in other words, these folks don't know what it's like to be from a small town. And I know everybody hates that, but you know what? It resonates.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to move on to another aspect of the race, which is the race and race. We talked about a lot of different ways that race has come into play. And now you have a life-size effigy of Senator Obama hanging from a tree on the campus of George Fox University in Oregon. It was founded by Quaker pioneers. And Anthony, you've been blogging about this. Do you think that this is clearly an attack, first of all, and is it important that this was a school founded on nonviolent and Christian principles?
That's the great irony of the situation. It was clearly a protest against Act 6, this attempt to bring minority and low-income students on the campus, that is, students that are historically unrepresented. I mean, we're talking about a school that has less than 1% African-American our presence on the campus, 2% Native American, around 5% Asian, 4% Latino, and the school is desperate to get students on. And there's always backlash among established whites, often when set-aside programs are developed to encourage greater minority presence.
And we should make clear that there was a cardboard cutout message saying specifically that, you know, opposing the minority scholarships.
Absolutely. And so what's really troubling, however, is the ongoing persistent tactic of protesting against these sorts of things by whites, where the default mode of protest is to lynch a black man on a tree. We see ropes hanging from professors' offices all over the country. We saw this with the Jenna 6 case down in Louisiana. There's something troubling about the fact that even in so-called Christian community, there is this default mode where youngsters have learned that that you protest against blacks by hanging a rope around a black man's neck. And my sense is that they've learned those things from the elders, because in Christian circles, it remains one of the last bastions of America where you can be a racist and a Christian. And sadly, that won't get challenged too much.
Oh, well, that's going to be a nice controversial one for letters. Issa, you also teach. What do you think of the environment on campuses these days? I mean, is there increasing tolerance or still problems?
Well, I teach at Hunter College in New York City, so it would be difficult for an intolerant student to negotiate that space. The student population really represents the world. I think that, you know, there is this level of violence abroad with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which comes home to our communities when the service personnel return, but also in the language and support of the war. Although there is a backlash against it right now, that sort of violent language is still very much in place. In addition to what happened in Gina, Louisiana, just recently the sixth white defendant admitted his role in the torture of Megan Williams in Charleston, West Virginia. So I think black women are also being attacked, physically assaulted, lynched, if you will. And it's troubling. You know, an interesting aspect of being black in America is that you have to deal simultaneously, sort of psychologically handle the victory and thrill of accomplishment and weigh that against the inevitable backlash that is a very often expressed in physical violence, symbolic or actual. Whether you look at our success in World War II and then the lynchings that followed of, you know, black veterans in uniform, you know, we have this wonderful triumph with Barack Obama and his ascendancy. And yet this backlash just affects all of us on such a deep and visceral level.
No, we're just going to have to wrap up. And it's interesting you mention black veterans, because we're going to talk about that in a second. But guys, I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We were talking to Issa Yulin, who blogs at issayulin.com. She was at NPR's New York studios. Charles Robinson, who blogs at Charles Black Politics blog and joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog. He joined us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis.